Welcome to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. Each week, we explore the way beliefs shape our world, our politics, and our culture. How can we learn to be brave when we find ourselves in challenging moments? It's the question Marianne Edgar Buddy tackles in a new book, released to coincide with the third anniversary of the day former President Trump used military troops to clear the streets so he could walk a few steps from the White House to the historic St. John's Episcopal Church in Lafayette Square for a photo op. Right here. Moments before, tear gas and rubber bullets were used by military and law enforcement to clear the area filled with peaceful protesters who had gathered by the tens of thousands calling for justice after George Floyd's murder by Minneapolis police. In that moment, Buddy had to draw on reserves of courage she didn't know she had to confront what she saw as the president's usurping of spiritual authority.
This is an excruciating moment, a crisis moment in our country where we need healing, where we need reconciliation, and we need justice. And the president, after clearing with tear gas and riot-geared police the park and the courtyard of our church, stood in front of St. John's and held up a Bible as if it were spiritual validation and justification for a message that is antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and to the God of justice.
I spoke with Buddy from her offices at the Episcopal Diocese in Washington, D.C. Right, Reverend Marianne Edgar Buddy, thank you so much for joining me on Inspired by Interfaith Voices. It is a pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you. The pleasure is mine.
You decided to write a book about bravery. You speak to this question of how to be brave in the world without speaking to the tremendous fear so many are experiencing and this, for many, a desire to recede, to right. not engage in the difficult conversations, in the discomfort. And you wrote this book not just for Christians. I will say, and I'm not, mm-hmm. as I told you, and listeners know, I'm not of the same tradition. I wasn't raised as a Christian. So, but I found the book really, really powerful. Why do you feel this is the book you had to write now?
Thank you. Well, the title, for me, the operative words are learning to be brave, right? That it's a learning process and that life presents us with moments. And I call them decisive moments. Those moments in life when we are conscious, we are aware that something is either happening, is possible, is beckoning or summoning us, and we are being invited to respond. And how we respond in that moment is a lesson in courage, right? It is an invitation to courage. And the reason I wrote the book is that I was given the opportunity because of the events that brought me into momentary public life back in 2020, in the summer of 2020, which was about as emotionally charged a summer as this country has experienced, certainly in my lifetime. The coming together of the global pandemic, the series of racially charged murders at the hands of either vigilante citizens or police officers, culminating in the murder of George Floyd, our president at the time responding with what I would only consider just responses that increased the tension as opposed to trying to mitigate and to bring us together. And I responded to that in a way that became part of the news cycle for about a week and a half. And it was when the former president had promised to, he had a speech in the Rose Garden where he basically said he threatened to use armed forces against peaceful protesters across the country. And there were protests all across the country. And then in that very moment, the order was given to forcibly clear Lafayette Park outside the White House, which is also adjacent to one of our churches, so that the president and his entourage could walk across the park, stand in front of St. John's Episcopal Church while he held up a Bible and took a picture with all of his military and governmental people surrounding him. And I objected. And I objected because he was assuming the mantle of a spiritual authority using a Bible, sacred text, standing in front of one of our churches as if that were a justification for his response to that critical moment in our country. And because I responded when I did, which was just a fluke of the moment, I call it a stepping up to the plate moment, and that there was just no warning, it just presented itself. And because of the sort of the eyes of the country were on that moment, that part, my response for a short period of time became part of the story. So people were making a lot of assumptions about how brave I was in that moment. And I had to ask myself, was that, what about that was brave for me, right? Was that actually a brave moment, or was I on autopilot? Who else was being brave? Was I simply taking my place among people who were being a lot more courageous than I was. And what did that all have to say about how you learn to be brave? And I wanted to extend the camera lens and say, let's talk about those moments. Let's reflect on how they come to us. Very few of them are public in that way. Most are private. Some are known only to us and to our God. Others influence our families or set our lives on a particular course. Others are the result of tragedy that come to us and we have to decide how we're going to respond.
I'm going to read something too that you wrote.
Okay.
You wrote, "Stepping up to the plate when you aren't ready is the price of beginning. It's what you do most time and again when moving towards something important and becoming the person who is able to do or accomplish what is currently beyond your ability. You show up, take your place, step up to the plate and swing and miss and miss and miss until one day you make contact."
Thank you.
I love that because I think we live right now in a time in which so much of everything we do is documented and focused and scrutinized.
Right.
And we have in the back of our minds an awareness of the scrutiny,
yeah,
and our fallibility. What was so striking to me was your recognizing the challenge of you getting in front of that microphone was far different than the young person who was skipping school,
right,
missing work, or risking being pepper sprayed or hit by a baton or arrested,
right. Right.
For standing up in civil disobedience to cry out in pain and call for justice for the murder of George Floyd.
And also to be careful not to assume that the most important thing about my leadership was that moment, right? Because the most important thing about my leadership is how moments like that inform how I live my life going forward, right? When the microphones aren't in my face and that it's, and the adrenaline is gone. What's it like in 2023 to be working in the field of, or in the work of racial justice? It's very different, right? That the pendulum has swung and it's not, you know, it's a very different world. Am I giving up now? Because, do you know what I mean? Like there's just a...
Oh, I know exactly what you mean. There's this thing called Twitter and Facebook,
right?
and Instagram and social media, you know?
And we just move on. So yes, there were people who are putting far more on the line in that moment. But at the same time, recognizing that, okay, this is where I am right now.
You're not using the word power. You also had power that someone in the street didn't have. Talk about your power.
I did. I had power in that moment, and I had to decide how I was going to use it. So in that moment that you described, when we were setting up a press conference so other religious leaders could do their bit and I was going to say my part, and we basically, the media displaced a whole bunch of people who were protesting that day on the street. It was a very hot June day. And they set up the cameras and the lights and the microphones. And this young person just said to me, "Would you sit down and shut up?" Right. And I looked down at him and I thought, he's absolutely right. So I sat down, right? Because then I just listened. And he was not at all impressed. He just thought, you and your, so I, and I wasn't, it's like, I wanted to use my voice whenever I could in the environments that I could, right? So I did. I'm sorry I wasn't on Interfaith Voices because I tried to get on every single show I could.
I did.
But I also knew it was a short-lived thing. Right?
Yes.
I knew it wasn't going to last. These things last for about 3 or 4 days and then they're gone. So I thought, okay, I'm going to ride this wave and then I'm going to be thankful that it happened, grateful that it's over, get the adrenaline out of my system and go back to my day job, right? Which is to do the hard work of justice and community building and lifting people up. And, you know, that's my work. But in that particular moment, I also wanted those young people to know that I thought what they were doing was actually the brave thing, right? And I don't know if I communicated that to them or not. They were pretty disgusted with all of it at the time. So in that moment, I wanted them to know that I was embarrassed to be the one grabbing all the attention when in fact they were the heroes.
It's a complicated situation for someone who wants to center and empower those who are on the forefront. I could hear you wrestling with that and trying to sort and inspire, I think, a certain reader, you know, who's out there wondering what it means to not have the power that you have.
I feel like the most important chapter for people who are significantly younger than me in the book is the one about deciding to start and to recognize that God does place within many people a dream or a vision of what their life could be or the contribution they can make. But that getting from where we are now to what that destination is a long and winding and complicated road, right? But if we don't start toward it and keep moving toward it, we will never reach that destiny. And so to aspire to a position of influence or power, however you define it, of change agent is wonderful, but also to recognize that it's a long road to get there, to get what, and it's fleeting, but it's also like, just start moving and exercise the influence that you're given at whatever place you're in and learn what you need to learn to get to where you feel you want to be.
You believe deeply, and I'm not saying you don't, that people feel a calling, that they feel that. Being able to hear that and knowing it, it sounds like a blessing the way you're describing it. But for somebody and for a lot of young people who don't believe that there is something greater, they don't believe that there is something greater.
Yeah, I hear that. Walter Brueggemann said that one of the great tragedies of the modern era is what he called a heresy, that you can live an uncalled life, right? That it's possible to live an uncalled life. Mm-hmm. And so to say that in non-religious terms is to say what a tragedy it is and what a deprivation of the human experience not to feel that sense of movement toward a larger vision or a larger goal. It doesn't have to be religious. It can be an artistic one. It can be a one of physical capacity. It could be one of learning, but that sense of being drawn outside of ourselves, drawn outside of ourselves into a realm where we are on a journey of discovery and of contribution that is iterative. Like we're being changed and we're growing as we are expanding our understanding or our experience or capacities.
You know, I really appreciate you putting that in terms that are perhaps accessible to someone who doesn't necessarily subscribe to or believe in a divine calling. So, but there's another part of this conversation in the book about lessons learned when we step up and fall down.
Right.
You said a third and perhaps the most faith-affirming way we experience the call to step up is when we are feeling mired in the complexity and contradictions of our lives, to be summoned out of the quagmire of self-absorption to do something brave and good in a completely different sphere is sheer grace.
Well, and I'm reading along too. And then the last sentence is, it's a relief to think about something else, mm-hmm. right? And that's my experience. And I have to say, it gives me faith. It reassures me that God is still with me, even when I feel least worthy of anything worthy of God, where I, like I said, I'm in that quagmire, I'm spiraling down, right? And then someone calls me up and says, hey, can you help me do such and such? Or one of my kids calls me and we have a half an hour conversation and I feel like I could step out of myself and just be truly present to him. And it doesn't change anything about the complexities and the contradictions of my life. But for that day or for that moment, I was lifted out of it and was able to do something of meaning for someone else. And that's so liberating.
My guest is Marianne Edgar Buddy, author of the new book, How We Learn to Be Brave, Decisive Moments in Life and Faith. When we come back, Bishop Buddy tells me how she went from an evangelical teenager to one of the most powerful women in the Episcopal Church. Stay with us. You're listening to Inspired by Interfaith Voices. Hi, friends. I hope you're enjoying the show so far. I just want to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being part of our community. I don't know if you know this, but we are on the air all the way from Richmond, Virginia to Ketchikan, Alaska, and in so many places in between. We're a national show, and we are a small and mighty team committed to bringing you stories and sounds from around the world that convey not only the diversity and the pluralism of our country, but the beliefs that are shaping our world, our politics, our culture, and the ideas that sustain us and inspire us to think about where we are going. And that brings me to this question. If you value us, if you enjoy listening and appreciate what you're hearing, I want to ask you to take a moment to consider becoming a sustaining member of Interfaith Voices or make a one-time donation at interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. That's interfaithradio.networkforgood.com. Thank you, and let's get back to the show. Welcome back to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. My guest is Marianne Edgar Buddy, Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Washington, D.C. Before the break, she described being thrust onto the national stage when she forcefully responded to then-former President Trump's commandeering of St. John's Episcopal Church in Washington, D.C., turning the historic church into a backdrop for his Bible-waving photo op after the murder of George Floyd. But Bishop Buddy is no stranger to scrutiny. She was the first woman to be elected to the top spot of the Episcopal Church's influential Washington, D.C. diocese. In her role, she serves as a spiritual leader for 86 Episcopal congregations and 10 schools in the District of Columbia and 4 Maryland counties. She is no stranger to controversy.
I've been ordained now for over 35 years as a priest in the church and now 12 years as a bishop. The women before me paved the way. We were talking earlier before we started recording about Bishop Jane Dixon, who was an auxiliary bishop here in the Diocese of Washington. And women like her in the generations before me, in our tradition, were the ones who were making the road that women like me could then follow. And that has been true throughout my ordained life, which is not to say that there weren't people who were hesitant to think of me as the diocesan bishop. But I would say that when I was elected, the overriding experience was one of affirmation and joy. We have other tensions around leadership that have surfaced in, you know, in other ways around other people, namely LGBTQ people, and constantly having conversations about access and equity for people of color. That's a big part of our struggle as a church. I want to see a church where all people can offer their gifts regardless of their defining characteristics of gender, of race, of socioeconomics, of background. And I feel in our tradition, we've made some real strides in that direction, and I'm proud.
Talk to me a little bit about what and how the diocese is speaking to the LGBTQ community today.
The Diocese of Washington, in our faith tradition, was among the forerunners in having stances of inclusion and celebration of LGBTQ people. It's been a learning curve, and there have been times when there's not uniformity now, and there certainly wasn't as much consensus as we're enjoying now around the full welcome and understanding of LGBTQ people as created fully in the image of God, that don't need to change or be healed of their orientation sexually or of their gender identity. One of the things I've come to appreciate, and I've had a couple of painful learning episodes in my own experience as a bishop, I forget sometimes, given the people who I have the privilege of working with, how precarious it can feel in our culture right now for people who identify as LGBTQ, who have trans children, who are living in other parts of the country. And as we're watching, especially now, some of the legislative decisions that are being made across the country, there is a sense of danger and of a need for people to know where they stand in relationship to the communities that they're a part of. And so I think right now it's especially important for our traditions to be explicit in our, not only our welcome, but our affirmation and celebration and our full inclusion of people in all walks of and all levels of leadership, to say that in this church, there is no distinction. And so we have to hold steady and be as explicit an advocate as we can be for full human dignity in this country. It's a delicate balance because we don't require uniformity of thought. Our unity is in Christ. It's not in our positions on one issue or another. And I feel like that is a place of real integrity. And sometimes people who are in my communities will say, Bishop Marianne, I feel like you're asking us to be generous with the people who don't believe that I am a child of God, right? You wanting, yeah, and that, you know, that's really challenging. And I'm hearing that more and more.
Yeah. How do you reply to that? How do you talk to that from your experiences and from your faith and from your vision of what you want your community to look like?
I wish I could say I have a good answer. What I try to say in that moment is to acknowledge their right to be who they are and to acknowledge that in that moment, they're being asked by me or someone else to pay a disproportionate price for the sake of moving our community forward on in the issues of justice or of full inclusion. I am eternally grateful to the people, both in our history and in our current life now, that have the capacity to embrace what Dr. King called redemptive suffering, right? Which is at the heart of our tradition.
What is redemptive suffering?
Suffering that a person individually takes on, absorbing the suffering for the sake of a greater good.
Do you think that the concept of redemptive suffering is understood in our culture?
Not universally, but those who do understand it are among the saints among us. I think the people who embody redemptive suffering best would never ask anyone else to do what they do, but are willing to pay that price themselves and are willing to accept what they would never have chosen. But since it has become their fate, they choose it as their destiny and allow grace to work through them. that's for me the greatest of mysteries in human life.
How did you become so invested in the belief that Christianity is a big enough tent for all?
Well, I had a formative experience early on when I walked away from a version of Christianity that was very narrow. Like, if you weren't walking this very particular path, you were not saved, your eternal salvation was in jeopardy, and we had the right path, right? And that's where I sort of came to faith. And from
and that, was that young life on campus or in school, club?
It was partly young life, but it was actually lived out mostly in one particular church community. And believe me, this community loved me and were kind to me, but I knew even at 16 that that wasn't right. So I was primed, I think, from an early age to be open to the fact that there's a lot of diversity of understanding when it comes to God. It has stayed with me my entire life. My closest friends in college were Jewish, and we realized that we had more in common with each other as practitioners of our respective faith traditions than we did with some of our nominal Christian, for me, nominal Christian friends, for her, nominal Jewish friends, who really didn't feel that all that called to walk the path. Similarly, when I became exposed to the writings of Martin Luther King and how he was influenced by Gandhi and later Thich Nhat Hanh, I began to just see, okay, we live in a world and we are a created species, and clearly God, our creator, loves diversity, right? Now, do I believe that all teachings are equal and of equal value? I don't, but I would say that about Christianity, right? I think there are some aspects of Christianity that I cannot accept given what I believe, right? Similarly, if I were exposed to certain things that would say to me, no, if that is your belief, I honor that, but I can't accept it, particularly if I feel like it diminishes humankind in some way, right? But to be open to truth and to listen, and particularly in a pluralistic society, to be deeply respectful of how people practice their faith, not to say that you have the right through your faith to, as I said, to do harm to people. I believe that there are certain principles of human dignity that are universal and need to stand the test of, I think on some level, our religious traditions have to be held to that standard. It's allowed me to be both committed to the path and inviting people onto this path without the assumption, and this is controversial in Christianity, but without the assumption that it is the only path, right? Mm. And I get into, you know, that is a hard conversation for me to have with other Christians who say, but isn't Jesus the only Son of God? And doesn't it say in scripture that through him all are saved? And I say, yes, it does. And I believe that. I believe I have been called to this path. Even St. Paul in his writings would say, you know, so you're called to this life and not all are called. And so I can't, that's above my, you know, that did not land in my portfolio to figure out. Like
how do you see young people, those under 25, like how much of a priority, and how do you engage and speak to young people today?
My goal in the time I have left as bishop is to provide as many pathways and access points for rising generations to take positions of leadership in the church. Because in all honesty, at age 63, my best hope is to be the kind of elder that younger people
are. Do you really think of yourself as an elder?
I do. I'm in my 60s. I am an elder. And I'm embracing that role with as much intentionality as I can. I want to be an elder. Otherwise, I'll just be an old person, right? And I mean, not everybody gets to be an elder. Not everyone, you can just grow old. And I want to be the kind of older person that a younger person feels blessed by and blessed. I want to be wind in the sails of those who come after me. And so part of my strategy now is to open up as many possibilities as I can for leaders who are 20 to 30 years younger than I am. And whatever mentoring I can provide for just how to navigate this system, right? And also to bring what are some of the gifts of maturity, and also then to listen, because what is needed now, what is expected now, what is happening now, isn't my natural milieu. I'm not going to be center stage in this work. I'm backup. I'm providing resources.
Wow. I really love that you just said that. You are the right Reverend Marianne Edgar, buddy. And you just said, I'm not going to be center stage. No. I'm going to be backup. Wow. Yes. I don't think I've ever heard a man in a leadership position equivalent to yours say that.
You know, I think one of the things that I'm trying to teach is our preferences are not the most important now. Now, our preferences in worship, our preferences in music, our preferences in how we like to spend our time, as important as they are, and they are important, but this is the season of generativity. Ours is a giving back and to make and making space. And I feel like part of the crisis right now is that we have elder generations that don't know how to grow old and don't know how to let go. But I also feel like if I can help my peers learn that lesson well in the time I have left as bishop, we will make space for rising generations to take what this particular faith tradition has to offer and follow the Holy Spirit into a way of being church that might be a blessing to themselves and to their communities, right? Mm. And I don't quite know what that looks like, although I'm seeing glimpses of it. And I feel like that's one of the things that the church can do is to say, hey, remember how how messed up we all are and how imperfect our lenses are. And could we at least provide, as one of my colleagues would say, space for grace for all of us?
That was Bishop Marianne Edgar Buddy of the Episcopal Church's Washington, D.C. Diocese. Her new book is How We Learn to Be Brave, Decisive Moments in Life and Faith. When we come back, we'll look at the history of Juneteenth. You're listening to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. Stay with us. Welcome back to Inspired, a production of Interfaith Voices. I'm Umbreen Khan. 2023 marks the third anniversary of the federal holiday, Juneteenth, the day in 1865 when enslaved people learned that slavery was over. In Texas, the Union Army came to Galveston and Major General Gordon Granger issued Order No. 3, declaring that the former enslaved people would now be in a state of absolute equality with whites. The order, though, does not capture the cultural or legal events that took place before, nor does it answer what happened after. Pulitzer Prize-winning historian Annette Gordon-Reed wants to teach the country why Juneteenth is a necessary complement to Independence Day celebrations. In On Juneteenth, released in 2021, she weaves together personal experience growing up in a multi-generational family in the heart of Central Texas, alongside the legal and social dynamics that shaped her. From the schools she was allowed to attend to painful traumas that exposed the vulnerability of being a Black American living in an unequal society. In 150 pages, she makes accessible a powerful story that brings into focus complicated ways social, legal, and cultural forces resist change. But getting personal was not exactly comfortable for Reed. Memoir is not her favorite genre, she explains.
This is not typically what I do. I'm more detached in my other writings of history. I'm outside of the story in a way. I might talk about myself in the introduction, but once I get into the story, to the history, I move away from it as much as I can. But I also thought that this would be a way of reaching a larger audience to talk not just to adults, but I really want this to be the kind of book that teenagers, young people could pick up and perhaps identify with a narrator who is being open about herself and her life, and how, you know, to some degree, we're all a part of history. We could all tell the histories of our times by talking about things that happened in our lives. And so I wanted it to be accessible to lots of people. And I know memoir, I have to confess, has not been, you know, one of my favorite genres. but I...
Yet here we are.
Yeah, but here we are. Exactly. And I try to deal with some of the problems I have with the form by talking about myself as little as possible. I mean, I mentioned my mother and father's names and a handful of other people. But I thought that the more I went into like a family genealogy and family tree and talking to everybody, then it would become more memoir than history. And I wanted a particular balance. And I thought that by being present, but not too present, would help me maintain that balance between memoir and actual history.
As a historian, do you feel that there's a pressure to remove the potential subjectivity that a person brings when they identify with the subject that they're teaching or talking about?
Well, yeah, I think we can't be totally objective. We all know you can't have total objectivity, but you should not be substituting your desires and your wishes and placing them on the people you're writing about, on the circumstances you're writing about. Yeah, so that's definitely there when you're writing a memoir, and you the parts that are about you, these are my impressions, you know, and they can't be wrong in that sense. I mean, I can be wrong about factual things, but when I'm talking about my feelings, you know, how my experiences, how they affected me, there's some freedom in that too, that you don't have to end note that.
As a professor, as a woman, as an African American, do you find history presented as objective that in fact is more subjective or selective in the narratives that are included?
Well, yes, I have seen that. That's what my first book really is about, Thomas Jefferson and Sally Hemings, An American Controversy. It was going through and seeing the way historians who were writing about the story of Jefferson and Hemings had preferences about the answer to that question, whether or not they had children. And it led them to ignore evidence, to accept evidence that was less than supportable, coming into the matter when you're dealing with a topic that was very touchy for people and meant a lot to folks. I mean, that's why history is an art. It's not a science. There's no magic formula. And sometimes you hit the right balance and sometimes you tip over, but it's the attempt and the good faith attempt that I think that people respond to.
When you encounter someone who says, "Explain Texas to me," what do you say?
Well, what I think it's really important for people to understand is that Texas is part of the Southwest, and the emphasis has been on the Western part of it. When you think of Texas, you think of cowboys. I did a language study program in France when I was in college. I lived with a family and they knew I was from Texas and they had an understanding about what Texas was about. It was about the desert in a way. It was about, you know, cattle. And I think that that's the kind of predominant image that people have of the place, when in fact, the southern part of Texas is incredibly important to the formation of the state and to the culture of the state today. Texas was a slave society. Stephen F. Austin, from the very beginning, understood that slavery was going to be critical to the enterprise because the people he was bringing over from Georgia, Alabama, and the other states came with the expectation that their property rights in enslaved people would be protected. And Austin says, if people came to Texas without the institution of slavery, they could expect to be poor for a very long time because, you know, it was backbreaking work in felling trees and turning East Texas into a part of the Cotton Empire, which is what they wanted to do. So most people, as a matter of fact, have lived in the eastern part of Texas, which is the Old South. It's very much like the Old South. And so I would tell people that a lot of the things that are coming out of Texas, these are racial questions that grow out of the racial hierarchy that was created by the institution of slavery, and that continued even after slavery was ended, even after Juneteenth, 1865, when slavery ended in Texas. The question of Black citizenship and Black voting was controversial among many whites and has been something that they've been fighting since that time period. And it's interesting that here we are dealing with the same kind of issues. Once you understand that this is not about cowboys and oil men, as exemplified in the movie Giant, which I'm sure many people have heard of if they haven't seen, that tells a narrative about in the beginning, Texas was a place of the cattle rancher and cattlemen and cowboys. And then they were challenged by the oil men, the people who struck oil. And then the two of them come together when oil is discovered on the land of the cattle ranchers. So they become one society, but they leave out the plantation owner.
A land of infinite variety and violent contrasts. A land where today's ranch hand can become tomorrow's multimillionaire.
They leave out the kind of people who came over with Stephen F. Austin and created Texas as part of a cotton empire, growing cotton and sugar cane and other crops. My ancestors on both sides of my family were brought from other parts of the Deep South into Texas. My mother's family on one side, I can trace back to the 1820s in Texas, before Texas is a republic, and certainly before it becomes a state. And my father's side, at least the 1860s. And their ancestors came from these other deep southern places to, you know, recreate the slave society there. It's really important for people to understand that, because you understand the racial mores and the political life of the place.
When you look at the events around Juneteenth celebration, do you feel like they told a full story of what Juneteenth means and what happens even after you have a legal proclamation?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Black Texans understand this very well, because we have been celebrating this holiday since 1866. The first anniversary after 1865, you know, kicked off these celebrations that have gone on. And they're typically, when you have them in public places, there are speeches that are given, there's music and so forth. There's an educational component to it. And I think Black Texans understand that even though there was great joy at hearing the news that enslaved people would no longer be in slavery, would never be treated as property in the way they were before, they knew they were in for a struggle. They were amidst a group of people who were still very hostile to them and were hostile to the idea of incorporating them into the society on an equal basis. I've used the phrase hope amid hostility, that just because chattel slavery ended, it did not end the racial hierarchy. The culture of the place, the culture of education, of voting, of social life, all of those kinds of things were still geared towards maintaining this hierarchy. And it's been a fight ever since then. So it's a hopeful story in lots of ways, but I'm hoping that people will, as the years go on, have more of an opportunity to reflect on the ways in which it was still going to be an amazing struggle. even after the end of slavery.
There are growing efforts to update social studies and U.S. history books to more accurately reflect the events that surrounded chattel slavery, Reconstruction, and the era of Jim and Jane Crow in the United States. And that's been accompanied by a growing number of attacks, specifically on social studies and U.S. history teachers. How do you respond?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot going on with this. There's a concern that when you talk about what actually happened, that young people will feel bad about it. And, you know, they should. You know, it's impossible to read stories about people who had their families taken from them. You know, mothers separated from children and husbands separated from wives. It was a tragic situation, but it happened. And you have to talk about what happened in the past. History is not just the fun things that happened or the good things that happened. And that has to be put forth. So I think that there's a concern about a notion that this will make people unpatriotic. The feelings of white children are paramount here, saying that, you know, we don't want them to feel bad about things that their great-great-grandparents may have done. Well, you know, I don't know what to say about that, because those things happened and you have to talk about them. And it's pretty much saying as well that the feelings of Black children don't matter. Mm. So that if you're a Black child and you know that your ancestors were enslaved, you're not supposed to talk about that because you will make your white classmates feel bad. That doesn't work. You know, that doesn't make sense. If things happen, you have to talk about them. Talk about them in an age-appropriate way. I mean, as we do everything, the way we present matters to children. But they have to be discussed. There are people who don't believe or suggest that the situation that African Americans are in, the sort of inequality that exists, that this is all our own making. And if you talk about the past and you talk about the ways in which society organized to stop Blacks from advancing, it supports the idea that, you know, we've been up against it, that we've been fighting against. It's not a level playing field.
Where does religion come into this story?
Well, I suppose it comes into the story among African Americans, because most Black people have used religion as a coping mechanism for them during slavery and after slavery, as a way of maintaining a sense of faith that things would get better. So I think people in the Black community, many of them have been buoyed by their religious beliefs from the very, very beginning. And certainly religious figures have been more traditionally the leaders in African American communities.
You describe Texas as a promised land to Stephen Austin, using almost biblical language. And I'm struck by how the language of liberation and freedom was understood by two different communities in very different ways.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there was a Black church and there was a white church. And in the white church, it was eventually, it wasn't always this way, but certainly the pro-slavery ideology in the South was very much tied to religion. I remember going through a diary of one of Thomas Jefferson's grandsons who's going through the Bible and finding references to slavery as a way of justifying the existence of the institution of slavery. Now, that's something Jefferson would never have done in that generation of people. But certainly by the time that we're talking about with Juneteenth, these people are the heirs of the Second Great Awakening. And in the South, that tied very much into pro-slavery ideology. And of course, in the North, they went the opposite way. White abolitionists saw in Christianity a call for abolition, the liberation of African-American people. So a lot of it seems to be people using religion as it happens to suit their particular maybe earthly desires, answers to things, using religion to buttress their views about stuff. So all these people are claiming from the same Bible, claiming answers about the nature of or the the rightness or wrongness of slavery and coming to different conclusions about it.
Annette Gordon-Reed is the Carl M. Loeb University Professor at Harvard. She's an award-winning author of several books, including The Hemings of Monticello, An American Family, for which she earned a Pulitzer Prize in History and the National Book Award. She is also the past president of the Society for Historians of the Early American Republic. She is the current president of the Ames Foundation, and over her career has received many honors, including a Guggenheim Fellowship in the Humanities, a MacArthur Fellowship, the National Humanities Medal, and the National Book Award. That's all for this week's show. If you're interested in finding out more about our guests, head over to this week's episode page at interfaithradio.org. While you're there, you can also sign up for the newsletter and explore the archives. Take us on the go. Find our podcast wherever you listen. Just search Interfaith Voices in the podcatcher of your choice. And while you're there, help us out, leave a review and a rating. It helps others find us. This week's episode was produced by Kimberly Winston, Kevin McCarthy, and myself. A special thanks to our founder, Maureen Fiedler, for her vision, and MC Yogi for our theme music. Additional sounds by Blue Dot Sessions and Audio Binger. Inspired is a production of Interfaith Voices, and we rely on the generous support of our listeners to bring you this show. Wherever you are, friends, I hope you are well, I hope you are safe, and I hope you stay connected. I'll see you next week.